listed as 12 out of 100. Very few publics are in that spot. And we have about $1.2 billion in research spending, and we're either the third or the fourth largest university in terms of getting federal research spending dollars. Sizable financial strength that's been built up over many years. We spend about $6.4 billion a year. A significant portion of that relates to our health system and our medical school, and the rest is for our campus. Our endowment is about $8 billion, as you could see there. And we're also proud of the bond ratings, which are the highest possible with Moody's and Standard & Poor's.
Thank you. And not to interrupt you, I'm sorry, but I just want to let the record reflect we have a quorum.
Thank you. One thing that has challenged us over the years, and I'm sure it's challenging universities, public universities across the country, is really declining state appropriations over the past decade. And if you look at this chart, you'll see that had our appropriation grown from 2002 at the Consumer Price Index, we would have been receiving $451 million in financial support from the state. We today receive $273 million, $178 million gap. We are very grateful for the state support the university receives. A couple of years ago, the state had a sizable financial crisis, a $2 billion budget gap in the general fund, I believe. And the state has since turned things around, and our appropriations are either flat or increasing slightly over the next several years is what we're seeing. The Michigan story is an interesting one because we are in a state which has had significant economic challenges with the declining of the auto industry, the aging of the population, really the restructuring, the painful restructuring it takes to be competitive in a new economy based on information and financial services and so forth. So the question I get around the country when I travel to professional meetings and such is, how has Michigan been able to compete with the top academic institutions in the world at the same time that its state has declined its support and in residing in a state with such economic challenges? So that's a piece of the puzzle I hope to get to today. We have several core financial principles. So the first one I'll list is a disciplined operating budget strategy. What this means in the layman's terms really is careful. We are very careful of what we add to the budget. As many of you know, whether it's state government or the universities, when a program is invented, it tends to stick to the budget long after its useful life. So we're very cautious about what we add. We continue to diversify our revenue stream. Research is very important. Patient care is very important. Tuition is important. Our state support is important. Donations and gifts are very important at the university. So we're continually seeking to diversify our streams. We have a long-term capital investment strategy with emphasis on infrastructure renewal. The university has spent more than $5 billion over the last decade of its own resources, largely in improving our capital investments, which is the buildings and so forth, classrooms in the university, research space and so on. Utilize debt very conservatively. We preserve and seek to grow our endowment, and one of the ways we do this is with our endowment spending rule. And then the last bullet, which is where I spend my time today, is really the sustained focus on cost containment that we have. Okay, so we think about cost containment in really three periods. And we pitch cost containment across the university not as something for its own sake, because cost containment isn't very fun, but the idea is that cost containment is really needed for us to fund our IS priorities. We're looking at reallocating savings from administrative areas, other areas to fund our IS priorities, which you'll see in a second. In phase one, we achieved $135 million in recurring savings to our budget. In phase two, we saved $100 million in the year that just ended of recurring funds to the budget process. And in phase three, we are targeting to save $120 million a year, which is what I'm working on right now. And if you add these three up as part of our base budget, multiply it by 10 years, it's a significant amount of money that we can redirect into holding tuition pressure, the pressure to raise tuition, holding tuition down, and in just staying competitive. And for the past 10 years, the last bullet, all our new investments have been funded through the reallocation and savings. the major cost containment efforts. Right here, just give me a second. Major cost containment efforts. The first is we have assessed our academic programs as well as our centers and institutes. So we have it's a slower process, but it's a thoughtful process of saying which centers that were put into place 10 years ago are active. How are they performing? Are they still relevant? So we have an initiative there that's run by our provost's office to really look at academic programs. And the second piece is health benefits. We're constantly comparing our health benefits to the market. We look at the portion the employee pays versus what the employer pays. We're also looking at areas such as retiree health care, improving our pharmaceutical plans, et cetera, pharmaceutical purchases, and so on. Next is facilities maintenance improvements. We look at areas such as how we manage our inventory for our facilities, how we staff the work to occur on buildings, how we schedule the work. And there are several millions of dollars of opportunity in looking at how facilities are managed in large organizations. We looked at rationalizing our IT. We found that we spend more than $300 million on campus per year on IT. Multiple data centers, multiple networks, every major entity having its own approach to research computing, more than 30 email systems, 170 organizations that do end-user support for desktop, and we got our deans and we got our unit heads to agree this is not an effective way to leverage our IT spend. Our IT spend should go to differentiate what we do at the university, not replicate what each other does. And so we've had significant success. We're still in the process of consolidating how we approach IT. And I would say not only does the university have an opportunity to do this, so does state government. So this is a big opportunity. And I know from Senator Bonhoeff, you've made some headway in this area, which is great to see. Next is strategic sourcing and procurement. And this is simply, again, the analogy at state government would be every department buying and doing business with whoever it wants. We have that multiplied several times in a university. And so we got together, looked at we spend about $1.6 billion annually buying things at the university. So we looked at where could we standardize and have preferred contractors as part of a competitive bid process who give us deeper discounts the more we buy. So we've had some success in this, about $20 million just in the 4 years I've been here recurring we're on track to achieve. And lastly is the administrative shared services, which is of interest to all of you today. I'm not going to drain this slide, but really here are the things we do with our cost containment efforts, recruiting faculty. At the peak of the recession, we added 150 new faculty. Few schools were able to do it. I don't even think many of the Ivies did this. And part of it was, again, reallocation of savings from cost containment. Continued focus on student-faculty ratio, and we're looking at what the online world means to the University of Michigan, as I'm sure the University of Minnesota is doing as well. We plan for renewal of key academic facilities, so some portion of increase in tuition goes to a fund where we renovate a major building every 2 years rather than borrow to do that. And that's been very successful with support of our deans as well. Maintaining the university library collection and then expanding undergraduate financial aid, which now totals over $100 million. So again, in very difficult circumstances, we've been able to add a double-digit increase to undergraduate financial aid. And then we did very well on the Department of Education's recent report on college affordability. Okay, so in looking at administrative services in a university, one of the things that you recognize is these organizations have significant difficulty in achieving savings compared to similarly sized corporate entities. Corporate entities are managed through a hierarchy. There's a CEO, there are division heads, they have operating plans, and there's strong directives. Not quite as strong as the military, but pretty strong. A university has relatively weak hierarchies, right? A president is influential only to the extent that they're persuasive. And so deans operate fairly autonomously. It's just a culture of higher education almost everywhere. And so over time, what is a good idea, which is letting schools and colleges have autonomy in designing academic programs, very important. They stay relevant to the marketplace. Each faculty has a good idea of how to respond to the marketplace and what needs are of students. But what's happened is administrative services have been dragged down and have turned into areas of the same level of autonomy as the academic programs, which really doesn't make sense. So we had a situation of 20 separate arms of the university doing accounts payable, which is really paying vendors. Why? Right? There's nothing distinctive about a college having its own accounts payable function. So, you know, finance, HR, procurement, even student services, research, communications, all replicated. Lack of standardization in processes. You know, incremental decisions rather than you're the best business practices. In the for-profit world, you have competitive pressure that gets you to change things. We don't face those pressures until very recently, right? The entire industry is now facing these pressures. We seldom use the enterprise systems that there are already that we've made investments in. We tend to grow new systems instead of leveraging what we have. We focus so much on the busy work that's very tough. I mean, these organizations have difficulty giving decision makers like you information, right? The analytical work. Administrative functions are staffed to support peak demand. An individual school like a School of Music has difficulty getting scale, right? It's a very small school compared to a big college like engineering. And lastly, academic units should focus on academics. They aren't meant to do administration of the type I'm talking about, HR, finance, any more than administrative units are meant to do teaching, right? So the idea here is administrative services aren't core to what a school or unit does. And lastly, when you fragment everything in terms of administrative services, you run into control and compliance issues, and those can lead to multi-million dollar fines for how you manage the grant and so forth. So we started a benchmarking process in 2009, and the idea of the benchmarking process was nobody knew, and I saw President Kaler's comments similarly in the Wall Street Journal, nobody knew what we spend on different administrative activities when I got there in 2009. We knew what we spend in a particular college. We know what we spend in athletics. We know what we spend on housing. But in terms of what do we spend about across finance or procurement or HR across all of these different units, the number wasn't in any budget, which is the reason we did this benchmarking exercise. We wanted to find out how much we spent. And second, how we compared to the private sector when it makes sense. I would argue payroll and accounts payable, you can compare it to the private sector. Cost of a paycheck shouldn't be any different, whether it's state government or the University of Minnesota or Best Buy, for that matter. But there are functions that universities do where there isn't a private sector counterpart, such as research administration, fundraising, student services, and so on. And we went through the benchmarking process, and I'll just share with you some of the highlights. I know the University of Minnesota, from what I read, is on its way to doing a similar exercise. So we use the Hackett Group's approach. They're a benchmarking organization that does this in finance and HR and so forth. And what Hackett wants to do is, sorry for the consulting words, they want to determine how an organization performs, which is the star, and it's a hypothetical star, compared to the world-class organizations, to the best organizations in across industries on that particular dimension. So if you think about Dell Computers, Dell might be a high performer in supply chain. They may not be a high performer in HR. I don't know. But the idea is to take the ones that do it the best and look at how the university compares, not just to private firms, but also to our own peer group. And we would include large major research institutions in our peer group, like the University of Minnesota. And so we went through this exercise to see how we compare. And the short story is, and these are similar results for Berkeley, University of North Carolina, because of the way we're organized, not because our employees aren't talented, not because we don't spend enough on technology, it really had to do with the way we're organized, we ended up falling in the fourth quartile, kind of the lowest quartile of performance on many of these dimensions. Procurement was the exception. Cost of administration and procurement was more in the middle of the pack. But for finance, HR, and IT, we were definitely at the bottom of the pack. And since then, I've worked and looked at results of some other higher education entities, and they all tend to be similar in this dimension because, again, of the way we're organized. And here's a sample, an illustration. And what you see here is, you know, I just took finance. Two-thirds of the cost of finance is outside the central finance organization. So here's an example. We spend roughly $23 million in central finance, which I am responsible for, another $45 million all over in different schools and units. We have 245 people doing central finance. We have another 530 in the schools and units. And this pattern of ratios is replicated in many of the functions. And you'll notice, you know, we have certain professionals and managers doing a lot of the transaction and clerical work, which you wouldn't see much of that in private industry because professionals and managers should manage and they're more highly paid. So this mix is a bit odd in this case. So we use data like this to develop our strategy for how we're going to attack the cost structure.
Excuse me, Professor Miranda.
Yes.
I just wanted to make a comment to the members. So we saw the university's report where they showed their spans and layers with regard to finance, but that was just finance in central. One of the things that Professor Miranda shared with me is that that did not at all take into account finance, which could be spread through the colleges and schools, and that's really what you were underscoring there.
That's correct.
Thank you.
That's correct. And so the top bullet point, just to continue that dialogue, about one-third of the costs are centrally located and two-thirds are in the colleges. So I saw the Simpson study. Senator Bonhoff's staff was kind enough to share it with me before the meeting. I did a quick review, and that study does look at span of control in your central functions, but really the story is incomplete. I don't view it as extremely positive. I don't view it as extremely negative. I think when you get the spend of the schools and colleges, you will have a more complete picture. Because in the case of Michigan, the span of control issues are really more at the school and college level, where you might have one manager supervising three people. In our central units, we do have a broader span of control. So just, I don't want to be overconfident and say expect a similar pattern, but I think you'll find more opportunity when Simpson does the more comprehensive look at costs. 75% of the work done at the unit level is transactional. Again, most units, you know, if you talk to a dean at a typical university, they'll say that the administrative staff in their school does something unique to the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts, maybe, right? And what you find is, no, about 75% of it is very similar to what's done in central functions. Processes are fragmented. Again, I talked about the misplaced professionals, higher mix of managers and staff, lower span of control, underutilization of the systems, and then minimal appetite or use for outsourcing. We don't outsource a whole lot of things at the university. I'll say that at the outset. But there's certain kind of functions now with respect to cloud computing where it just makes sense to because you get scale, whether you're in state government or whether you're in, you know, in a university. And we were making very minimal use of outsourcing, even in areas where the outsourcing market is mature. And we don't really have a competitive advantage to provide that service. So what's the size of the opportunity from this exercise? It really varies by area, but we're looking at savings of about up to $80 million, achievable savings of up to $80 million just based on the benchmarking idea. And I'm pretty confident that we're well on our way to achieving a big portion of this $80 million at the university. And that's what this slide really conveys. Okay, so in terms of what is in our scope, and I call it Shared Services 1.0, so we decided we had a huge subset of functions we looked at. Because change is difficult to pull off all at once, we decided to focus on a narrow subset of finance functions, a narrow subset of HR functions, functions that didn't infringe or compromise teaching and research. And we got support from our deans and from our executive officers and the president and the board to pursue shared services in these functions. In fact, they're very enthusiastic that compared to laying folks off, compared to raising tuition, compared to a number of things, this is just a more modern approach to management. And so Shared Services 2.0, my last bullet, really says if we pull this off and we're successful in these functions, we've got another set of functions we look at in the future that are already on the drawing board, but getting this right is very important. And so for us, it doesn't stop with these functions, but getting these right and then potentially looking at other areas is on the drawing board. Shared services means many things. For some functions, you might want to have multiple centers at the University of Minnesota provide the service. Research administration might be one. You might have a research administration hub for the humanities, one for the sciences, and it may make complete sense. For many of the administrative functions, we're moving to the model on the right-hand side, really a one center that provides these services. One management hierarchy, one underlying technology, a streamlined one business process for accounts payable, and I think it makes sense, but I don't want it, by no means do I suggest one size kind of fits all in this model. So you could go the regional route for some centers. I think it is an improvement, but it's, for many of the back office services, one center makes the most sense. So the cost savings, we believe 17 to 20 million will be achieved annually. Our investment is about a one-time investment, about 30 million to achieve 17 to 20, which is a reasonable, very attractive business case. The things we're, what causes the savings, span of control, standardizing the processing, just eliminating work that adds no value. And there is a number of work that adds no value. So we have a rule that says under $75, you don't need to turn in receipts. Many folks continue to collect receipts, and every one of those expense reports that's passed on is added up over and over, and at some point the transaction cost isn't worth that small degree of control. Also, we have huge variability in salaries. We pay central administration pays according to the market or tries to mirror the market. We have, in the decentralized units, widely varying practices for how they pay. So when you bring the staff together in a shared service center, you can impose a salary discipline that may be something like being it, having it pegged to market or some percentage off of market. And so 2,700 people will be impacted in terms of this was the work they were doing. It's not as if 2,700 people will be reduced. Those are the people that work in this area in some way. It's a much smaller full-time equivalent. Because you might be doing accounts payable for 10% of your time, and 90% might be related to something else. So, but it will impact a lot of people. Some people will be reduced through attrition. There's one reason to do the shared services, which is holding quality constant. Actually, two reasons. You want to at least improve the quality or hold it constant. The second one is to reduce costs. And unfortunately, these are people-intensive services. So it does involve reducing people. But if you plan for it right, especially with the demographics we're seeing with retirements, you can do it with minimal layoffs. I know organizations have approached this that have done this with minimal layoffs, but the key is to just to plan well ahead, not fill every vacancy right out of the gate. So right now, as we have vacancies in functions like accounts payable, we're looking and thinking twice in filling those because it will prevent a layoff down the road as we do this. Shared services design and implementation. Here's the way I kind of rolled it out. You measure your efficiency, you conduct the business case analysis, you design, and then you implement. We're in the early part of our implementation. Our first major service will be up and running in April of 2014. It'll be finance. We've got some guiding principles and vision, which I'll leave you with, but you see some of the principles. Central entities today in universities, in state government, often operate as monopolies. They give you a budget. It's a take it or leave it budget. You might be able to increment or decrement them. And this really is a radically new model. It's where the customers have a big say in the service. The customers, if you get too expensive, the customers can walk and buy the service from a third party outside the organization. They evaluate the service center management. And so forth. So there are a number of principles that make shared services very different from just centralization. Our implementation timeline is shown right there, the timeline for implementation. And so as you'll see, a number of things, change management and communications, the building the business processes, designing the organization, finding the facility, setting up governance, making sure the customers have a voice. You know, it, shared services also requires investments in new technology. There's no free lunch. You will have to invest in building the center, building the technology if you want to save the money. It's not simply moving the pieces around. Some of the design and implementation challenges, you need funding for the project. You need sponsorship across the university. It shouldn't be a project led by the CFO of the University of Minnesota. The provost's office needs to be an equal partner, and the president needs to be a strong supporter if they were headed in this direction. Minimizing the impact of faculty teaching and research, we're very careful not to dump work on the faculty and call it a savings, because then they're not doing research, they're not teaching. It's not a good way to save money. It's not a good way to be effective. We're managing the impact on the workforce, as I said. And then the last bullet is there is a skepticism in higher education, which is, can a corporatist model, something that came out of the corporate world, work in higher education institutions? And I think we're definitely in the first quarter of this transformation, but we're seeing the early results. You know, you have a shared service center up and running at Yale University. Berkeley is near the tail end of some functions and turning a shared service on. So I don't believe that this model will have difficulty in the university environment for the right services. Some of the tips and traps. First thing is, don't migrate and run off and do a shared service. The important thing is to really look and, as you're doing, you know, measure the efficiency of where the University of Minnesota is today. Look at where the opportunities are, tackle the ones that have the least risk, highest probability of success, and so forth. Second is the governance. I do believe in the new model, the customers need to have a much bigger say, much more commitments to the service being delivered, almost contractual-like commitment. Approaching the project as a comprehensive strategy, we didn't just pick on finance or just HR. We looked at finance and HR and procurement and IT and student services and fundraising. Every one of these had a central component and a decentralized component. And so look at things comprehensively and then choose a piece of it to go forward on. Top-down approach doesn't work in these areas, so we've had our workforce very engaged in the planning and the work. These projects are very difficult to pull off by yourself. You do need some outside consulting support. Hopefully it's consulting firms that have done this over and over again, and so you don't have to make the same mistakes. A number of things need to go well to get the value. So it's hard, you know, if you have an approach that says we're going to move to a shared service, but everybody gets to sit in the school and college where they sit today, it's not going to work. If you have a model that says we're going to do a shared service, but we're not going to share how we arrived at pricing with our customers, that won't work. If you don't commit to services, that won't work. You could end up spending more money. That's not, that has happened on occasion, which is this quality of the service is poorly delivered by the service center, so the individual units go back through the budget process and ask for more money to do their own thing again. Site visits can increase the confidence. I'm sure there's some companies in Minneapolis and in St. Paul that are at a shared service model. Most of the Fortune 500 have it. You could visit those and see what they've done and what they would recommend. And lastly, you know, I would say don't implement too big, don't implement too small. Find kind of the right mix, as we believe we've done with the 8 areas that I showed you. And so I will take some questions. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. And just so members understand why it is that I asked Professor Miranda to come here, as we look at our role as a higher ed committee, we look at things like tuition, we look at student debt, we look at making sure that there's high quality delivery. But as part of that mission, it is incumbent upon us to be able to provide direction to and use of the taxpayer dollars to say that we want to make sure that our dollars are being spent the very best of our ability and student directed. And so within this process, we heard from President Kaler on Tuesday. They have committed to tackle this. And so I thought it was important for the committee to hear best practices, what really is happening around the country, so that we can evaluate as we go forward what we hear and put metrics in our performance funding that are related to this particular issue. So we'll be coming up with, you know, like last year, we'll be coming up with 5 performance objectives, and we'd like to have one related to this area. So with that, I'll open it up for questions. Senator Pratt.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Dr. Miranda. Whoops, sorry. You spoke about the funding gap, and certainly we've heard from the university that they've experienced the same thing in our state. What has been the impact on student tuition as you've done your cost savings plus experienced a funding gap?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had the graph, but literally the funding graph line looks like this, as you saw. The student tuition line looks like this. It's been, we've tried to blunt it with the savings numbers I've given you, but the funding gap does put pressure on the tuition increases. We do have some board members that want 0% tuition. Other board members are more flexible, and our position as an administration is really to be aggressive on the cost side so we can get the tuition increases we need to stay competitive in faculty retention, et cetera. And what will happen if you just legislate 0% increases or do it through the budget process is the best faculty at Minnesota will be snatched away probably by the nonprofit private institutions. That's a pattern we've seen. We made some positive strides when the endowments of some of the privates went down in the financial crisis. We had a chance, a rare chance, but now those endowments are back. And so I think the University of Minnesota administration, you know, being very aggressive on the costs, you being convinced that they have been, I think that makes that tuition increase discussion go a lot smoother. We don't whine about the decline in state support. We really don't. I mean, it is a given. The state has its own challenges. They've done made remarkable progress on the budget side. And so, again, we just do believe it's one of the best economic development investments a state can make. And so we try and position ourselves to say we've done all we can.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Klassen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Miranda, back on slide 6, you talked about funding the highest priorities of the university. I'd be curious if you could share with us at the University of Minnesota what might be some of those highest priorities. And then secondly, when doing strategic planning at the University of Michigan, how many years do you look out? I'm just curious.
Yeah, and so at the University of Michigan, as in many universities, we don't have one big strategic plan, believe it or not. And that's very common because these are distinctive businesses. And even the strategic plans I've seen that universities have, they tend to be all very similar. You know, we want to excel at academics. We want to promote sustainability and so forth. So what we do have is we have a long-term financial plan. And we have a three-year model, and it's more increasingly being pushed to more of a five-year model. So we like to talk to our regents in looking out 3 to 5 years. And really, our annual budget is within that 3 to 5 year context. So again, not a long-term strategic plan. We do have it at the individual level, the Ross School of Business as a strategic plan, because the market is a bit distinctive that they're in. I know our medical school does. I just worked on one for the health system. But what we do have is the integrated 3 to 5 year plan.
Then, Doctor, you talked about funding the highest priorities, and I'd be curious in what some of those highest priorities are.
Yeah, they do change over time. So for a long time, our focus was on buildings, and that's the $5.1 billion number over the past decade. And I think we've done that. We still have a little bit more to go there. It's not to say all our needs have been met, but our facility condition index has gone up. So at one time, it was more around bricks and mortar. But now it's really more around, again, trying to keep undergraduate tuition down, trying to improve the diversity of the student body, which is challenging. Financial aid, that would be another priority. Those would be the areas. And then just capacity. Research is becoming more and more important to what we do. At the same time, the sequester and the federal deficit is going to make research dollars more competitive. So really having the capacity to be competitive on the research side. And those would be ones that I would rattle off right now without better notes.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, Professor Rwanda, thank you so much for being here. And we will consider you a resource as we
thank
do
you.
Our work. And I appreciate your willingness to share your story. And thank you very much for coming. And the audience was exceedingly patient, and I appreciate you all sitting through that. But I know you know that keeping costs down is important. So,
thank you again.
Yeah, thank you very much. So There are some people who are in the audience who are here because of Senator Claussen's bill, which is regarding tuition, and there are some people who are here for the DREAM Act that can't have a seat. And so if you're here for Senator Claussen's bill and you're just as happy to take a walk until his bill is up, feel free to free up your seats so that more DREAM Act people can come in.
He's going to orchestrate that.
It would be great.
Okay. Senator Pappas.
That makes sense. Yeah. Thank you. And then you'll be able to come in.
I wonder if we should wait for
this. Yeah. So we'll just take a short break as we make that transition.
I should have the letter that we sent with the general amounts.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise,
do you
have
a copy for me?
Yeah. Right. Thank you.
This is the Citizen League, and then on the back?
Yeah, on the back is all the signatures, including Chamber
David
of Commerce
Olson.
And other groups.
Do you guys know
all right.
That?
Do you guys have...
What?
We're not using it, no. Do you have this letter from the Citizens League
okay.
for the members?
Great.
You have it? Everyone has it? Okay, great.
How much of a break do we have?
2 minutes. Yeah, we're going to start right away. They're just letting people leave and people come in.
I know.
Talia.
Talia.
Talia. Ta. Somehow there's got an H in there.
That was a big transition.
I am known as Paco, but my real
name is Paco.
It's a nickname.
Paco's fine.
A lot of people left, now Rose is
gone. Well, we can't, it doesn't really matter. No.
Francisco.
Makes me sound more mature.
Yeah, it does.
Right.
Wow.
It's going to talk about, it's going to last 45 minutes.
I still don't think it's a guaranteed thing.
I hope they defeat it.
What are we missing that we care about?
It's my bill number.
I
don't even know what it is.
This year it'll go.
It's unfortunate. We are going to have to.
Sad. So refer to education finance.
23, hearing this.
Sandy.
This is the higher end.
Okay.
Workforce development. The economic development and jobs.
You ready?
And then we'll. Does everybody come? Oh my God.
What do you think? How do you think?
Okay.
Got
it. Senator Pappas.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm very pleased to be here this afternoon to present Senate File 723, which would allow undocumented immigrants who have been brought to Minnesota as children, many of them, but who have attended Minnesota high schools and graduated from Minnesota colleges, many Minnesota high schools, many with honors, to attend Minnesota colleges and the University of Minnesota and pay resident tuition. What's happened with a lot of these students, and some of them will be testifying here today, is that they grew up as Americans, they speak English, they worked hard and studied hard, and they got good grades, only to find out upon graduation from high school, that their dream of going to college is not attainable for them because they find out that their parents do not have documentation and they would have to pay out-of-state tuition. And at the University of Minnesota, that's like $17,000 a year, and at Minsky, it's also very high. And so it's not affordable for them. So basically, that's the end of the dream. And we are there are two reasons why we need to allow them to pay in-state tuition. For their own development and for their talents and skills to be given to the state of Minnesota, but also for the purposes of the state of Minnesota, because we're going to be facing a workforce shortage, and we need their talents and skills, and we need them. We have them here. They're here, and they're graduating. They're wearing their hats today. To deny them that opportunity is just kind of unfair. It's not the American way. I didn't know I was going to get so emotional. I apologize. So just to briefly tell you what the bill does, it's very simple.
Senator Pappas, would you like to have the amendment before us?
Oh, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that. I do have an amendment that is the A6 amendment. It does clarify some language regarding the University of Minnesota. It corrects something in the title, and it does repeal rules that the Office of Higher Education has asked me to repeal that's also in the governor's proposal.
Everyone has the A6 in their packets. So Senator Torres-Ray moves the A6. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, we're not the first state to have done this, to consider this. 12 states have already allowed students to attend and pay resident tuition regardless of their status. And those states are as diverse as California, Connecticut, Illinois, Kansas, Maryland, Nebraska, New Mexico, New York, Oklahoma, Texas, Utah, Washington. Texas approved it when former President George Bush was the governor. The Kansas bill was authored by the majority leader, a friend of mine, Lana Olin, who was a Republican majority leader. It's had bipartisan support in the beginning. It's unfortunate that it became a little more politicized over the last few years, but I'm hoping to bring that back because it's really important, I think, for all of us, regardless of party, to support higher education for all of our people that are living in our country. And now with some opening and discussion about reform of immigration laws, I think this could be a very first step, probably an easy first step, toward providing some kind of legal status for at least these children who are left in limbo and really left with their future being taken away from them. So I won't say any more, but I'll introduce Talia Estrada, who's a senior at Central High School.
Very good. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Talia Estrada. I was born in 1995 in Lima, Peru. At the age of 4, my mother and my father left Peru to start a new life in the U.S. Due to the fear of losing our lives. They went in search for a better life. After spending my 5th birthday, my parents had everything prepared for me and my older brother to fly us into the U.S., and little did I know that was going to be the last time I would see my family. I came here in 2001, and I was enrolled in school 3 days later. I began kindergarten like any other child who was born here. Years passed, and slowly I began to forget my past. I no longer remembered living in Peru. I grew up thinking the U.S. was my home. It wasn't until high school when I understood how our government worked. Now that I know what a Social Security meant, I began to run into many closed doors. I knew my life was going to be a lot harder than others, but I didn't want to prove those who thought I wasn't going to make it right. Now I'm a senior at Central Senior High School in St. Paul. I have done more than 40 hours of volunteer service in the United Hospital and community events. I have maintained a grade point average of 3.5 out of a 4.0, which means I'm an honor student since freshman year. And I have completed biology courses at Hamline University as a senior. This all may sound so great. Even though I may have been accepted to the top universities of Minnesota, I face the fear of not being able to afford my tuition. My brother goes to Minneapolis Technical College as a part-time student. And even as a part-time student, my family still struggles to pay for his education every 6 months. Because I'm not eligible for financial aid, I am scared to think about how I'm going to support myself financially next fall. You may say there are private scholarships, but out of 10, I'm only applicable for one. It's frustrating, to think that all my hard work is worth nothing when it comes to scholarships. Just because I'm undocumented, my grade point average means nothing. It's frustrating to think that my own country that I love so much is making my future goals so difficult when I know I can do much better. I'm speaking now for many students here who have the same difficulties. We won't give up. And we will search and search for more open doors and to make our lives a little bit easier. I may have been born in Lima, Peru, speaking Spanish, but I have lived here and I consider Minnesota my home. I'm a believer and I am one of many dreamers. Please, I am asking you to support my dream. My dream is to one day become a neurosurgeon. So please help students like me succeed in life. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Estrada, for sharing your story, and I strongly support your dream.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, next we have Francisco Jimenez.
Hi. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Francisco. I am a senior at the Northfield High School, and I am currently 18 years old, and I've been in the U.S. since I was 12 years old. My dream since I was little, I always wanted to become a personal trainer. I got here when I was in fifth grade, and I didn't know any English whatsoever. I bought the planned Rosetta Stone. I started learning English because I knew that I was gonna. I needed to learn the language. Now that I've gone through middle school and almost through high school, my plan is to attend to a community college and then transfer out to an university and get my four-year degree, hopefully. And right now, I would have to work full-time job so I can pay for my tuition. I would be the first one in my family to attend to college, and in the long run, I want to be able to provide for my family. I remember when I was a freshman and sophomore in high school, my expectations and my motivation to go to college weren't as high as now because of my immigration status. And however, of the deferred action, I really feel hopeful now. Like, I have lots of hopes to go to college, and I am extremely excited. I honestly can't wait. This bill will make it possible for me to go to a college, and as an undocumented student, I've had many barriers to go through. For example, not being able to afford a college tuition, not being able to have a license, and all I can do is forward despite my status. So, Madam Chair and Committee, I am pleased asking you guys to support my dream so I can move on forward, please.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'd like to invite Mr. Mike Lopez from MNSCU and the Provost, Luis Mendoza, who are also here to testify in support of the bill.
Very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak. I am an Associate Vice Provost in the Office for Equity and Diversity at the University of Minnesota, and I'm also a professor and chair of the Department of Chicano and Latino Studies there at the university. I'm going to tell you a little bit of my background just because I think it's part of the...
I'm sorry. Can you say your name for the record?
Luis Mendoza.
Oh, I'm sorry you did that. Sure. Thank you. I didn't get it. Okay.
Tell you just a little bit of my background. As a second-generation immigrant, I moved to Minneapolis 9 years ago to chair the Department of Chicano and Latino Studies. I was born and raised in Texas, as were my parents, and my grandparents came to the United States about 100 years ago during the Mexican Revolution. It's, of course, important to understand that during that time, there was another revolution going on in the United States, and that was the Industrial Revolution, which there was a great need for workers, and that synchronized with the need for people to leave their home country in exile in Mexico, and it was mutually beneficial. And I think, to some extent, we have to keep in mind that that is the history of immigration to this country, and if we look back 100 years ago, because I tell the story of immigration to Mexico all the time as part of my research, is that 100 years ago, the largest immigrants in this state were the Germans, Norwegians, and Swedish. And there was a huge influx at that time because of things happening around the world and the need for their labor here. I'm happy to speak on behalf of the University of Minnesota for the importance of this bill. As a land-grant university, we take very seriously our requirement, our obligation to think about access for people to higher education. And as a land-grant university, as a Research One university, we have very high standards for admission all the way through. So when it comes to thinking about students that will attend the University of Minnesota, we're talking about students of high talent, of enormous potential, who can contribute to not only their own self-improvement, which is part of any immigrant community's dream, but also contribute to our state, our local economies, with their intellect, with their hard labor, with their innovation. Because we know, research tells us, that any country in the world that does not include and is inclusive toward integrating new immigrants into the economy and to the culture is no longer innovative. Immigrants bring innovation, and that's very important. They also bring a lot of energy because they aspire to achieve better than they did in their home country. So, and it's important to think about this bill, and I appreciate very much its name in terms of the prosperity, because I think it really talks about the mutually beneficial of who would benefit from this. Certainly, the immigrants, the students would benefit, but also the state. These are our students. They would be products of our secondary school system or have achieved their credentials to go to higher ed here in Minnesota. To that extent, I think we should claim them. And any discussion about the need to think about bringing immigrants in at the high end who can contribute to our society, as students who aspire to attend our education, we know that they're motivated, and we know that they've already proven they can succeed because they will have gained admission into a higher institution. I think supporting these students contributes to our diminishment of the achievement gap, if we think about it. Many, many students, and they haven't quite said explicitly yet, but maybe others will, if they see a dead end to secondary education, they often don't aspire to succeed because it takes them nowhere. It's a dead-end street. And you know from your own lives as well as your grandparents' lives that now more and more, a bachelor's degree is kind of like what a high school degree was a generation ago, and you really need to go beyond that. And I've seen from the experiences of our students at the University of Minnesota who are dream students that they understand the obligation, the responsibility, the value, and how that they – and I will say this. They have a clear sense that they need to be positive contributors to society because they understand that even though they may be exceptions to the rule in terms of figuring out how to fund their education, they really are also just representative. That is, there's enormous wells of talent out there that need to be tapped into, and we would do well to consider that. The part of the bill that coincides with what's happening at the federal level with the DACA program is extraordinarily important because we need students to not only get their education but also be able to work, here and contribute to both our economy as well as our brain trust in society here. The use of private funding is extraordinarily important. That does change our current status of what we allow at the University of Minnesota. But the use of private funding, we're talking about people who have take their own money, private citizens, we're talking about people because there are current scholarships around the Twin Cities and the state that do support these students to some extent, but it's limited. Not only are they paying twice, out-of-state tuition to fund them, but I would also say it comes not only from members of the Latino community, but from the broader community who understand that investing in the immigrant community is really investing in the state's future. So I would have you recognize, and again, to me that seems a simple adjustment to say that people can put their dollars to support these students because they understand that it's a good investment and that it's mutually beneficial. What helps the state helps them. We have a great tradition in this country, and I would say in the state, understanding that education is an important, if not the sole, a vehicle for social mobility. We cannot, to divest, to turn down an opportunity to say, to step away from that tradition is something we need to be very careful about. So I would say that we have an opportunity to think about the connection between people's merit and the affordability at the same
time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Professor Mike Lopez from INSCU.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Mike Lopez, Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs in Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I'd like to preface my remarks, Madam Chair, by making the observation that it says a great deal about the state of Minnesota that you have two Tejano expatriates to Minnesota testifying on a bill such as this. Folks who started from rather humble beginnings but are now executives in the higher education systems of the state. Minnesota State Colleges and Universities has taken a firm position in support of the DREAM Act. Senator Pappas may recall that when she authored a similar bill several years ago, our Board of Trustees did indicate their support. I'd like to read the resolution that was passed by the Board at that time. The Board of Trustees of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities supports legislation that will allow students who have attended high school in Minnesota for at least 2 years and who have either graduated from a Minnesota high school or earned a GED certificate in Minnesota to qualify for resident tuition rates, provided that the legislation does not conflict with federal laws. In other words, residents of Minnesota should all be treated as residents. We remain firm in our commitment to serving students from all backgrounds. Our students represent the breadth and diversity of Minnesota. As a reminder for the members of the committee, we serve anyone with a high school diploma or GED. We pride ourselves on the number of Minnesotans that we serve, not the number of applicants that we turn away. We serve not only students right out of high school, but adult learners, workers, and professionals retooling to update their skills or prepare for new careers. We serve more students of color than any other higher education provider in Minnesota, almost 60,000 in 2012. And we serve more low-income students than all of the state's other higher education options combined. To quote Chancellor Rosenstone, we are a place of hope and opportunity where students from all walks of life and from every community across our state come to prepare themselves for the jobs that need to be done for communities across Minnesota to be prosperous. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I wanted to point out a letter that was passed out to you in your packet on Citizens League stationery indicating support for this bill, signed by people like David Olson from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Citizens League, the Minnesota AgriGrowth Council, the Minnesota Private College Council, College Possible, and others. So we have broad support, and I could read off another long list of supporters, but I think this is significant here. Madam Chair, I know your time is short. We have a room full of young people who could testify, but
but we know that they are strong supporters, and really we're so proud that you're all here today. So are there questions for Senator Pappas? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Pappas, thank you. This has been a very long journey for you.
It's not over yet.
No, it's beginning again. So this is the first step, and I very much hope that you're successful. You cried, and you're going to make me cry, but I'm going to try not to. I see three generations in this room that have tried this. Mr. Juan Linares is here. He has grandkids now. I see Mariano Espinosa, who's been here for years. Alondra Cano, who just left the room. Juventino Mesa, who is here. Mrs. Maureen Cisneros is here. And I see names that now I don't recognize. The testifiers, being people that I know are working, and we haven't met. So there are a lot of people who have worked for these before you, and we're still here working. We are so proud. I am so proud of you. You have played by the rules. You have done everything. Everything the right way. You've gone to school and you're part of the 47% of kids who are graduating, because only 47% of kids that look like you graduate today from high school in Minnesota. This is less than half. And you're simply asking us for support to continue this journey. We have to do this. I thank you for being this strong voice for millions of kids in this country who have played by the rules. I am so proud to be here with you. I will be with you. I have been with you, and I will continue to be with you until the end of this journey. Thank you for being part of that 47% of kids who play by the rules. Thank you for doing what you had to do. It is our time to do our work and to support you to fulfill this American dream. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Torres Ray. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Torres Ray, for saying that. And thank you, Senator Pappas, for being here. Mr. Mendoza, my mother is from Texas, and my grandparents were from Texas. And the story of different immigrant communities moving to different places at different times is interesting and often misunderstood and misinterpreted. I would just say many on this committee know that my district includes 3M headquarters in Maplewood, and I live in Woodbury, and we have a lot of 3Mers there. And I've spent quite a bit of time with people from 3M talking about their future workforce needs as a specific example of what Senator Pappas referred to. They specifically say, after they face a big retirement, especially in some of the STEM-related fields, they're going to have a hard time replacing those workers. And they, in so many words, said, we can't home grow enough. We're going to have to recruit from the outside. And I say, we should home grow as many as we can, and we've already begun that process, and we see many of those faces in this room. And so there's just no excuse not to be doing that from here. And I will just close by saying that my husband and I did live in Texas when this legislation was passed there. And if Texas can do it, Minnesota certainly can.
Thank you, Senator Kent. Anybody else? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Pappas. And I actually don't ever do this. And I can be a bit of a bulldog in committee, as Senator Torres Ray could attest to just an hour ago. I actually would like to also thank you for bringing this forward. I think one of the things that I strongly believe in is that we need to do everything we can do for all people to be productive members of society. And these people aren't just undocumented. They're also Minnesota kids, as they've testified to. And they're most likely going to have Minnesota futures. And so it's in our interest to move forward with this. I do have a couple of serious questions, though, about the bill.
Senator Peterson.
As it relates to line 1.5 of the A6 amendment, could you just explain what we're doing there? I see some language on the University of Minnesota and why that's significant as opposed to what was in the original bill.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, and I'm shocked that Mr. Fuller missed this in the original bill. He's not claiming responsibility. But because the University of Minnesota is a land-grant institution that existed before the state, and they have a fair amount of independence from the state of Minnesota, we have a long policy and custom of requesting the University of Minnesota to do something rather than requiring them to do it. So we needed they almost always do what we request of them, but we do have that policy that we request it instead of require it.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Pappas, just one more follow-up question. How, what interaction or what effect, if any, is there on the state grant program as it relates to this bill?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, and that will be reflected in a fiscal note that's in process. But these students, as residents, they have to be treated, all residents have to be treated equally. So they would have access to the state grant.
Madam Chair, just one
yep,
more
Senator
then.
Peterson.
Since we mentioned the fiscal note, is there, will that also be coming to the committee for
yep.
the omnibus finance bill, or is this moving separately, or what?
Members, it would have been my intention to review the fiscal note today so that when we sent it out, we wouldn't have had to see it again. But the fiscal note is preliminary, and we're not satisfied with it. So we'll ask for the bill to come back to our committee in finance, and we'll review the fiscal note, and then it is the intent to send it separately to full finance.
Madam Chair, what's the action that you need to make, though, to meet the deadline? Do you need to send it to finance, and they'll come back here? Is that the process?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So we would need to pass it and send it to referred to finance. Any other questions? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, I'm maybe hung up on a little bit of a language thing here, and I think like Senator Peterson, I'm probably getting the reputation of being a bulldog in committee. But it says in Section 3, the student has filed an application to legalize their immigration status or will file at the earliest opportunity. We're going through the college admissions process right now with my senior. It's a pretty robust process. Why would we not require, why would we have language about earliest convenience versus requiring that filing for legal status prior to admission?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Senator Pratt, up until recently, there wasn't a process available for students to file for legal status at all. Now there's a new federal process. I can't remember what it's called.
DACA, deferred action
or something. So that means that students could file for the DACA, but it's fairly limited in its application. I have to tell you, I'm not even that familiar with it. So I wanted to leave the language in there that allowed for another process if the DACA process wasn't appropriate to the student. For whatever reason, that there would be another application they could file as soon as the federal government made that available for them.
And Senator Pappas and Senator Pratt, if you look at the language, it doesn't just say at the earliest opportunity. It says at the earliest opportunity the student is eligible to do so. So it's not like it's when you get to it. It has to do with eligibility. I had that same question. So that's what that does.
I'd like to move the bill.
And before that, I just want to, Chair's prerogative, just make a comment, too, because I'm at the legislature really because of my passion that each and every Minnesotan, starting with birth through post-secondary, has the opportunity to live to their full potential. And so this bill is one very important tool. And as we have talked about the workforce shortage, and then sometimes you hear people talking about the influx of immigrants as a problem. And I always think that's so misguided, because as we identify the workforce shortage, the influx of immigrants is actually our solution. And so this is a bill that allows our influx of immigrants to be a true partner in our solution. So thank you.
Yes, thank Senator you, Madam Pappas. Chair. Thank you, members.
Yeah. Now, Senator Torres moves the Senate file 723 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion is passed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, and before they move, I wanted people to know that the governor today declared Immigrant Day in Minnesota, and the mayors of the two cities did the same. So you should be very proud to be an immigrant in Minnesota today.
Nice. That's wonderful. Thank you, Senator Torres Ray. Very good. Okay.
Next bill is
Senator Klassen. Again, thank you all to being here.
Shocking, isn't it? And they're leaving. And some of them are coming for this tax credit, and they're going to leave. Because
there would have been Jeremy
the news. And to see if there's anything in here. He does.
The language that I introduced.
Son.
Okay, we're doing different things, I think.
He just confirmed.
That's still
This was on the original separation we got.
Yeah, and I do see him look. That's what I'm talking about.
Looks good.
I don't like that.
Well, those could be buried in public safety.
Oh, tell me about it. There have been several of them, right?
But he removes the $500
Sure, yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
I'm not addressing the issue.
But
if you want to keep that,
I don't want to do that.
Just the fact that the appropriation or...
No, it's...
I should maybe get the bill out.
$500
$500 Yeah. Girls are going to go, hey!
Well, and what happens if they go up...
Just, you know, sleds has these different components.
$500 You know,
this is the next one.
It gives me an excuse to get some tickets.
Yeah.
Seriously, nobody's
going to get
no. But it looks like he did remove all of the sales tax stuff.
Section 16, 11.23 through 25 You know, but and also from the taxes, I can fly them all down.
You get the
down.
Airfare for free, basically. But,
thanks. You too. I mean, I've been so busy with the health exchange.
Oh, wow.
This how they
well, I'll put my jacket back on.
You can just adopt them. Just adopt them.
I gave her a copy.
If I get my answers.
No, that's that one. That's that one.
See, look at how nice. Look at how nice we are to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know, someone gave it. David, you gave her by. Yeah.
So it's for Classman's bill?
Yeah. No. This is
Oh, it's for Senator Ken's bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
Here to represent the superintendent.
I thought you looked familiar. You were sitting over there.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Oh, Scott.
Oh, yeah.
It looks very scary.
It is open.
Thank
it's
you.
Very scary. My husband and I said, that's scary.
But you should check it out, Senator.
I think a bunch of our people would be back here.
And then I do know we're short on time. We do our best.
Thank you.
We can make it work.
Craving. Starving, exactly.
I've been doing the same thing.
So I haven't limited the security places.
Up tonight in the Judiciary Committee. Will probably
I may be back if I get my answer.
We'll see how it goes. We still have
see you soon.
The OAG.
Policy bills.
That is
shocking.
Just
OAG. Yeah, so. Yeah. Yep.
So if we can. Tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've got. Department of Vehicle Services doing the same thing.
The whole committee.
How you been, man?
All right. How are you?
Well,
bad.
I don't know where it is.
Someone
but, I do know. But I do know.
They're like dominant. Because it's exactly
they had as good.
Because it has oversight.
Just doing like a Nelson type.
Yeah.
You know, like Nelson's.
Very cool kind of
thing. A little bit of
a sand.
She did toss it for
me. Wonderful. I'll let her know.
Thank you. Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. Jimmy Truss in it.
Oh, put one right in here.
Good job.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing him in.
Maybe I'll look for that.
It was by design. It wasn't voice.
I figured that one. We didn't fly him in here for our health.
You and Dave are kind of like,
I know,
Jimmy all right.
Right.
We're going to stir up the bees nest.
Should be.
I know.
Right. I was telling you. See, I was just thinking,
yeah.
You know, how when we all work together well, it actually works well.
Oh, I wasn't good.
Quite a few friends. Just saying.
Oh, when I explicitly put into the statute.
I was really happy to be here. But really
they couldn't adopt such a rule.
Oh, my God.
Oh,
my God.
Yeah. What was his
answer? Sorry it took so long to get there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Better
one.
Well, those of you who are willing to give up your seats for the last testimony, thank you very much, and we're glad to see you back in committee, and welcome to those who are new. Senator Klassen, you have an exciting bill before us today.
How we do, Madam Chair. Thank you. For the record, my name is Greg Klassen. I'm a member of the Minnesota Senate representing the communities of Apple Valley, Rosemont, Coates, and Northeast Lakeville. And thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for hearing our proposal today. Madam Chair, I'd like to move author amendments at this time, A13.
Very good. About the amendment, it just gets it in the shape you want. Is that so?
Correct.
Madam okay, Chair. And members have that before you. So Senator Claussen moves the A13. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'd like to begin by just explaining Senate File 997. The file allows a tax credit against the tax due of individuals who have graduated from a Minnesota post-secondary institution and are paying principal and interest on student loans. And to be clear, a tax credit is the amount deducted from the total amount a taxpayer owes to the state. I wanted to make that clear so we understand. It's not a deduction. With this proposal, the credit amount allows equals the amount of principal and interest paid during a taxable year on a qualified educational loan up to $4,000. The credit also applies to employers who have made qualifying educational loan payments on behalf of eligible individual employees. There are limitations to the tax credit based on income. For an eligible individual taxpayer filing single or married filing separately, the amount of the credit allowed is reduced by $1 for every $9 that the eligible individual's income exceeds $39,000. And I'll give you an example. An individual filing single with an income of $45,000 and has made payments on a qualifying educational loan of $4,000 during the taxable year would be eligible for a $3,333 credit. Another example, if the eligible individual taxpayer's income exceeds $58,000, the credit is reduced by $1 for every $9 in excess of $58,000. And the example would be that with the income of $63,000 and has payments on a qualifying loan of $3,000, then the taxable year would be eligible for $2,300 as a credit. If the amount of a credit exceeds the taxpayer's tax liability, the state shall refund the excess to the taxpayer. However, an employer will not be eligible for any excess payment. And we all know that this committee has spent the last several weeks receiving testimony regarding the cost of higher education and related student debt. Senate File 997 outlines a program whereby eligible Minnesota post-secondary graduates would be eligible for a tax credit based on their individual income level and amount paid in principal and interest on a qualifying student loan. We also know that based on a 2010-2011 study, the cost of a college education in Minnesota can range from $6,800 to over $54,000 annually. Minnesota college graduates carry the fourth highest average debt in the nation for a four-year degree at just under $30,000 per student. The state also has the fifth largest percentage of graduates carrying student loan debt at 71%. Student loan debt has surpassed $1 trillion nationally, with 10% of the borrowers of federally subsidized student loans in default within 2 years of starting repayment. With this Senate file, I believe we need to send a message that higher education is a good investment, and as a state, we are willing to help students to guarantee their future and the future of our state. Senate File 997 allows post-secondary graduates to purchase homes, make investments for their future, and purchase more items in the retail market, resulting in increased economic activity. We have a number of testifiers in support of Senate File 997. At this time, I'd like to introduce Mr. Josh Winters, the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group Executive Director. Mr. Winters.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as the Senator said, my name is Josh Winters. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, or MPIRG. And I think the most important thing really is to shift to our testifiers here today. It's their stories that I want you to hear. My role as the Executive Director really is to represent the students on seven college campuses across the state. We are a student-directed nonprofit, and we work at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, Morris, Duluth, Augsburg College, Hamline University, McAllister College, and St. Catherine University. With that, I would love to bring up our first testifier, Molly Donovan, who is a senior at the University of Minnesota Morris and the secretary on the board of directors for MPIRG.
Welcome, Ms. Donovan.
Hi. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Senators. I just want to say thank you for your time today, especially today with the DREAM Act and both DREAM Act and Opportunity in Minnesota. These are huge steps in the right direction towards better higher education in Minnesota, and I was crying, and I'm so excited. And yeah. So thank you very much for your time. I know it's precious. So like Mr. Winter said, my name is Molly Donovan, and I am a student at the University of Minnesota out at Morris. I'm majoring in Spanish literature and history, and I also serve as the secretary to MPIRG. I first started saving for my college education, working a summer job after my junior year of high school, because I wanted to get a jump start on putting aside the money required to get a college degree and then look for a good job doing something I loved after graduation. I thought that if I could save enough money while still in high school, I could afford to give my college education the attention it deserves. But I see now that no matter how much I worked in high school, it would never be enough to pay. Long gone are the days of working only a summer job and paying for college. Now students have to work the summer job, as well as juggling part-time jobs during the academic school year, as well as tacking on internships to ensure that we get a job once we graduate. And that's still not enough for many students. Today we are wearing red as a symbol of the debt we bear and will bear for years to come. Red is the color for solidarity we share with the past, present, and future students of the state. As I head into my senior year at Morris, I've already accrued over $10,000 in student loan debt, and some of that is already getting interest. My work-study position pays $8 an hour, but because of my full credit load at school, I am only scheduled for five hours a week. The cost of living in Morris is significantly cheaper than here in the cities, which is awesome, but $80 every 2 weeks is not enough for anyone to live on anywhere. I promise you, I'm trying. So, like many other students, my summer and part-time work goes towards paying rent, living expenses, and books, and we're lucky if we can make even a tiny dent on our tuition debt before we graduate. That's why some other students and I came together to create the Debt Yearbook, and we hope that this project can start to tell the story of young people seeking a college education. I'm not sure how long this debt will be hanging over me, but I worry every day that it will prevent me from taking a job, improving my home community here in Minneapolis. I guess this is St. Paul, but I'm from Minneapolis. Or from following my passions by helping communities across the state. Please consider our future, my future, your kids' futures, grandkids' futures, as you hear the Opportunity Minnesota bill. And I just want to reiterate, thank you very much for all the work that you're doing here.
Thank you, Ms. Donovan. And are you a student grant recipient? Do you get the Minnesota student grant?
Yes, I think so. I get it's called You Promise Grant, something okay. In correlation with the Pell Grant. So
very good. Thank you. Yeah.
So I am getting some help, but it's still a lot.
Yeah. We agree. That's why we are very excited about this bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did pass out that debt yearbook that Molly Donovan just referred to. It should be in a packet each of you received. In that packet is a press release from some of the work we did this morning, general statement about the what we call an opportunity in Minnesota, the Senate File 997, as well as an economic analysis. So that'll be important later. But just wanted to draw members' attention to that. Next up is Alora Laval, a freshman at St. Catherine University.
Take your time.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Alora Lavalley, and I'm a first year at St. Catherine University. Why should we care about Opportunity Minnesota or Senate File 997? Not only has the total cost of attending public schools skyrocketed in the past decade, but private college students are collapsing under the load of tuition and fee increases in Minnesota. The yearly cost to attend St. Catherine University has more than doubled since the year 2000. And if we use the national rate of tuition increases to make an estimate, and this is even without considering fluctuations in the economy, about 7% annually, then in 10 years, it is expected to grow by about another $40,000. How can graduates begin to maintain a lifestyle that is remotely close to stable when they cannot escape the crushing weight of their higher education costs? How can they save for emergencies? How can they invest in their homes and their families? How can they undergo experiences that enrich their lives and ultimately make them better assets to their communities? change my initial question, why should we care about Opportunity Minnesota, to why should we care about Minnesota? And by doing so, I believe that our mission with this bill becomes very clear. The outcome of Opportunity Minnesota will reflect how the Minnesota legislature feels about its future. We are not only a state of forward thinkers, but of compassionate hearts and iron will. And you know that our statewide student body reflects that. And we're under more pressure to be exceptional than ever before. We spend days and nights poring over books. We work multiple jobs. We navigate the insane world of social media. We are champion athletes, elite scholars, and relentless artists. We are here, and we chose to invest in our education because it matters. Why not invest in us so we can create even more beautiful things for Minnesota? And why not allow higher education to become more accessible for the other 48% of college-qualified youth who cannot currently afford to go? We should care about Opportunity Minnesota because it isn't just about the students. It's about the businesses, the communities, the next generations, and the overall quality of living in our beautiful state. Thank you.
Ms. LaValle, did I say that right?
LaValle.
That expression, we are not just forward thinkers, we are compassionate hearts with an iron will, is beautiful. Good job.
Makes me in Minnesota, I guess.
Can we borrow that?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Okay, good. Next.
Yep. Next up is Heather Johnson, who's a senior at North High School in North St. Paul.
Madam Chair, I have to talk to Ms. LaValle. That was my mother's maiden name, last name. So it's interesting.
Oh, my.
Oh, a connection we weren't aware of.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Heather Johnson, and I am a senior at North High School in North St. Paul. I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 997. I am considering the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, as well as other institutions across the country, as I look towards my graduation in May. But my education won't stop after a bachelor's degree. My current path is to pursue biological sciences and continue my education into the medical field. It's daunting to think about the enormous pile of debt I will have incurred after pursuing further education into a master's degree and eventually a PhD. This policy would be an incredible incentive for choosing to stay in Minnesota after I have obtained my degrees. I am the youngest of three daughters in my family. I have not yet started my college education, and my family has already incurred over $40,000 in debt. This is an enormous burden for my family to bear, and for me going to college, it will only get bigger. My family is in the fortunate position of being able to take on this debt. However, I can say the same is not true for many of my peers, whom are choosing to forego a higher education for employment straight out of high school. My parents, as they graduated college, had little to no debt. The same is certainly not true for my generation. I want to stay and live in this state both for my education and for future employment. I understand the cost of higher education is not going to go away, but the effects of this bill could help me achieve my academic goals while allowing me to stay in the state that I love. I want this not only for myself, but also for my peers and for many future graduates. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for indulging. We had another high school student, and his testimony will be brief before we move to Elton. So thank you so much for indulging that. If Vincent Toulouse would come up, he's also a senior at North High School in North St. Paul.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Vincent Toulouse, and I am a senior at North High School in North St. Paul. I'm also here today to testify in support of Senate File 997. I'm one of the peers that Heather just spoke about, and I'm considering not going to college due to the overwhelming debt. Higher education is a huge barrier for all students, and I'm certainly no exception. I have already two sisters that have graduated with an enormous debt, one of which owes $24,000 alone in her undergraduate year. My family is a middle-class family that has a hard enough time providing for us as it is, which means if I were to go to college, I would certainly have to take out loans in order to do so. My parents are hard workers and immigrants to this country. They never had the opportunity that I have to get an American education. I want to take that opportunity that they never had and pursue that path, but at the same time, there are obstacles and other opportunities that wouldn't burden me with this debt. The cost and debt of a higher education is a real barrier for me in considering this path. If this bill were to pass, I can tell you it would directly influence my decision to get a college degree. I would go to college, and I urge you to pass Senate File 997 for myself and all those like me who wish to pursue their dreams.
Thank you. And what would be your career dream?
Well, I'd love to be a mechanical engineer.
Very good. Well, we need those. Thank you.
Thanks, Vincent. Last up is Professor Elton Micheresi, who is a professor in the Department of Applied Economics at the University of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Elton Micheresi. I'm an economist. I received my PhD in economics from Virginia Tech in 2007 and have been a faculty member in the Department of Applied Economics since then. I believe I was approached by MPIRC to take a look at this proposal that they had because most of my research focuses on education quality and education finance. So I did take a look, and then I ended up conducting some analysis of the bill to of the proposal to try and understand the likely effects of such a bill if it were to go through. So I will speak to two different aspects of my analysis, the fiscal side, what would it do for revenues, and then the social side, is it good social policy, what would it do to social costs and benefits from an economic perspective. So on the fiscal side, the approach was simple. If this were to go through, there would be two types of people. People who would still continue to go to college as was their original plan and would essentially not change what they're doing, and they would still continue to go to college, get a job. And then there would be some others who, absent the bill, would have chosen not to go because they would have thought that the amount of debt they need to incur to get a college degree might be too much to make the degree worth it. So the benefits will come from these people that change their minds because of the bill. So those people who would have otherwise foregone college and are now not going to do that, they're going to get a degree because of the legislation, are going to supply most of the benefits. So from a fiscal perspective, the cost is the tax dollars that will not be collected from all the people who would have gone to college anyway. So you are essentially paying them to do what they were going to do in the first place. So they'll still get their college degrees, they'll get a job, they'll just pay less tax. So the question that I asked was, how many people would we need to change their mind to justify paying for to justify extending benefits to everybody who is already in higher education, right? So that number is 12. Out of every 100 people who will receive benefits, 12 need to have changed their minds for this to be a revenue-neutral proposition in the long run. That's about 2%, 2-3% of the current high school graduating cohort. Then I took a look at other studies of programs in other states that have managed to make higher education more affordable to see if that is an achievable number or not. And it's achievable. It is not out of the question. Now, on the social sort of cost-benefit side, the social costs of a college degree are well known. Primarily, the biggest social benefit of a college degree comes in the form of higher wages. The second largest comes in the form of lower unemployment. People with a college degree are much less likely to be unemployed at any given point in time. And then there are further benefits like lower incarceration rates, lower reliance on public assistance programs. People with a college degree also end up having better health. People with college degrees will also be more informed and more eager participants in the political process. So some of these benefits are not easy to measure Others are quite easy to measure. So I try to put a dollar value on all the benefits that we could measure with some reliability. So the overall social benefit of a college degree in Minnesota is about, it's between $800,000 and $900,000 for a lifetime. Now, the social costs of such a program are harder to visualize because it's a tax break. As an economist, nine times out of ten, I would say there is no cost to a tax break. It's just benefit. You are foregoing all the social costs that taxes impose in the first place. So I think the reason why I accepted to take a look at this proposal was because of this mechanism. I found it very interesting. If you look at it from the viewpoint of a higher education finance tool and say compare it to a grant program or a scholarship program, right? A grant program would have to tax some people, bring the money in, administer it, and then pay it out. This doesn't do that. This just taxes less after one has been successful already and is already contributing to the economy. Granted, it's using the federal government as a bank to forward those money in the first the money in the first place. Also, if you look at it from a tax perspective, if I know opinions are divided on what's good tax policy, but if one were of the opinion that a lower tax on the middle class is good policy to begin with, then this is exactly that. It's a lower tax on the newest member of the middle class, provided they have obtained college degrees and jobs. So I think it's a very interesting mechanism that has many advantages and few disadvantages, or few to non-disadvantages. So thank you. I'll take any questions.
Yeah, I do have a question. Do you have a formula that you could, you don't have to have it today, but that you could provide us with? Because when you get your number of 12 people would have to do it, the first question I had was, 12 times what? What is your number that you're using as a, to the positive that offsets the 4,000? And then it sounded like from your longer explanation, it had to do with the values you assigned to various of those parts of your social equation, and then you extrapolated that out to get your number. And I think I'd like to see the formula.
Madam Chair, I do. I wrote two reports, a shorter report that sort of briefly outlines the logic and the numbers, and also a longer technical report, which I think has not been made public yet, but I would be happy to make it public.
You know, this bill would go next to the tax committee, and so it's my opinion that before it gets to the tax committee that you'd be prepared to share in great detail that formula.
Yes, absolutely.
Questions of members? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you might have just assured he won't be attending the tax.
I'm hoping Senator Claussen brings him there.
Do we have a fiscal note on the bill?
Well, members, I'm a little bit frustrated because while we are in policy, it's been very frustrating that we are not getting the fiscal notes when we're here. But what they've said is that because of the governor waiting for his budget, that everybody's been very busy, and therefore we'd refer it to taxes, and it would be a tax bill. It's a revenue estimate rather than a fiscal note because it's a tax provision. So we would bring it back here after it went through taxes. We wouldn't let it go.
Okay. And also, Madam Chair, as we have just heard, it's a little complex to figure exactly the tax implications, the fiscal implications.
No. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Claussen, just to get into, I don't know if it's just because I haven't ate all day or what, I'm having a hard time following exactly what's going on here. I see the $4,000 credit for the individual. And I see a $4,000 credit for the employer. So are the employers getting a credit and the individuals for a total of $8,000 annually, or am I getting that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, this would only be in effect for employers that choose to pick up the student loan from their employee. there are some situations where a young person is hired out of college, and part of that hiring is that they'll transfer that loan indebtedness to the employer.
So, Madam Chair, it's
Senator
Senator Clausen, it's either or then. So it's either going to the student that's paying their own debt load or the employer.
Correct. They would, depending upon the situation, either they would both be eligible, but only one at a time, if that makes sense.
Madam Chair.
Senator Peterson.
I'll just make one general comment, and I don't dig too deep into the kind of the ideological debate that you could have with this. I think generally, I generally question the merits, and I know this bag has been opened and spilled all over the place already, but of looking at another particular set of behaviors that the government is going to take a look at and say, this is a qualifying entity, and you must be employed here, and you must go to school here, and it must be this kind of institution. I generally question the merits of continuing to go about doing those things, but I also think it brings forward an important point about whether or not high tax burdens or low tax burdens are generally a good thing. And so, you know, what you acknowledge with a bill like this is, well, lower taxes is generally a good thing for folks. And so, you know, that's a theme that I wish was much more prevalent in the overall global conversation this session. I won't dig any further into that, but I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, sometimes, Senator Clausen, Senator Peterson, it takes different reasons to bring people to a same conclusion. So, very good. And I have been told that we cannot carry, even if this were to pass in the tax bill, we couldn't carry it in our omnibus bill. It would have to go on its own. But we certainly could review it as a committee for information purposes. Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Kent.
I just have a brief comment for the gentleman from North High School, and I want to encourage you to follow that dream. My husband was a North High graduate who became a mechanical engineer, and we've all established that 3M will be hiring. So keep at it.
Oh, very good. Okay, Senator Clausen, looks like you're ready for a motion.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 997 be adopted and moved to the Senate Tax Committee.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, and thank you, students.
Thank you.
And Emperor.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Our final bill of the day, Senator Kent. Just done like clockwork.
Had lots of students today.
Oh, yeah.
Shared transportation.
My short answer.
Okay. Parking is a nightmare right now.
What's that?
Nightmare right now.
I'm gonna ask.
So left empty out twice. Huh?
Yeah. Did you want it as an amendment?
Very unusual.
It's Terry. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the kind of
thing.
Pay for it.
I'm gonna probably answer some questions around this section.
I'll meet you out there.
They're offering all of
the red. Can we see you through the sea of red?
I'll just cut out and talk.
So I have the red.
Oh, okay.
But at least
everyone's
going to be there. Yeah.
So I started, if I had known, I was still going to be here.
Yeah, we'll come next year and
be 15. I think in 3 hours.
Yeah.
We did this one, so you have a formal amendment.
Okay. You have testifiers too.
Done, yeah.
She does. But yeah. Did it on Kent's bill?
But
did it on
the aide on Isaacson's side thought that you were hearing
as an amendment
to his bill today, but I didn't see the agenda.
No, right?
Yours is
not
kind of different.
That. It just got changed yesterday.
I mean, this is pretty yes or no type thing.
Yeah. It's up to you.
Your call, I mean. You can obviously offer your amendment. See what the chair wants to do.
Oh, we had that was an amendment.
Internet.
Took about an hour.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And Ms. Grimes, welcome.
I'm not going to take it personally that we've lost some of our audience. I mean, I don't
I try and do that every day, Senator Kent.
I am here to present Senate File 1041, which is the Office of Higher Education Agency Bill. So I do not understand why there's not the same level of enthusiasm for it, but I will get over it.
That's right, Senator Kent. I never understand why people aren't so excited to hear about cost restructuring at the University of Minnesota either.
I agree. And I do have Tricia Grimes here with me from the Office of Higher Education. A lot of this bill is technical changes and conforming language, but there are a few definite issues of real substance in here, and I will tease with a few issues that are of interest to this committee. We have some things in here dealing with SLEDS, the Statewide Longitudinal Education Data System, and MOOCs. And I will have two author's amendments, but I will save them for the end because they don't really fit in with the flow. They're sort of added. So I'll just let Ms. Grimes go through this and then come back.
And Senator Kent, don't you have an amendment you want to offer?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. We'll save those.
Sorry, I was thinking about her, yeah, what she told me.
We'll save those for the end, if that's okay, because they're a little separate. And so we'll just go through the, if that's all right, we'll go through the bill as we have it, and then these are additional. So
okay, fine.
Thank you. Ms. Grimes?
Madam Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education, and this, in fact, is our agency policy bill. Would you like me to go section by section through the bill? I can probably do that in less than 10 minutes. Okay, I'm going to assume that I should proceed. Okay, so Article 1, Section 1, has to do with the SLEDS, the Statewide Longitudinal Education Data System, and it explicitly gives the Department of Employment and Economic Development authority to share unemployment insurance wage data with the Office of Higher Education for the purposes of the SLEDS database. That way we can track what students are making after they leave college and what kinds of jobs they have, whether they're employed full-time or not, and so forth. And there'll be another provision that's parallel to this in Section 13 also. Section 2 is a change in the Higher Education Advisory Council. The Higher Education Advisory Council currently consists of the heads of the University of Minnesota, MinSCU, the Private College Council, the Minnesota Career College Association, and the State Department of Education, and then a member appointed by the governor, and in recent years that has been the director of the Office of Higher Education. However, under current law, the Higher Education Advisory Council advises the Office of Higher Education. So this would change it so that the governor would appoint the person who is going to chair the advisory council, and the council would advise the governor and the legislature, and it would also add the commissioner of deed to the Higher Education Advisory Council. Okay, sections 3 and 6 are rather technical changes in the definition of Minnesota resident. It clarifies that Minnesota residents who physically enroll at Minnesota post-secondary institutions, it corrects a thing that we did some years ago to try to make sure that a student who had no nexus with Minnesota couldn't get a state grant to attend an online institution. Well, at that time, we didn't really anticipate that there would be Minnesota residents who would be attending fully online. And we're clarifying that they can be a Minnesota resident, attend fully online, and be able to get a state grant. And frankly, we're also cleaning up some of the other existing language on residency that has accumulated over the years, with exceptions for Hurricane Katrina and those who serve in the military and so forth, and basically giving the office a little authority to exercise some judgment on those unusual cases that where residency is a bit hard to define in advance. Okay, sections 5 and 14 have to do with students who have to withdraw from education for major illness. We have already adopted language like this for Minnesota state grants in the past, and this is similar language for the post-secondary child care grant program and the work study program. If they withdraw from major illness, they get an additional term of eligibility, and their illness has to be documented by a physician. Okay, my summary just decided to disappear from my phone. okay, so then Section 6 is a change in the definition of independent student, but it's really just conforming. The federal government is supposed to reauthorize the Higher Education Act in 2013 or 2014, and when they do that, their definition of independent student will change numbers. So we're just generically referring to the federal definition so that we don't have to continue to change our law every time the feds change their numbering system. Sections 8 and 11 are a training requirement for private post-secondary institutions. It adds a requirement that private not-for-profit and for-profit post-secondary institutions make training available to all faculty and staff on information and advice to students with regard to student aid and transfer of credits. And I believe Senator Kent will have an amendment on that.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
Section 9 is one of section, and then all of Article 2 has to do with terminating institutions from participation in the financial aid programs when they don't do the right thing with taxpayers' money. In this case, it says that if the office takes action against the institution will be notified. It has the right to an administrative hearing. There is parallel language to this already. We have two sets of statutes that regulate institutions. One is for degree-granting institutions, those that offer associate degree or higher, and the other is for non-degree-granting institutions that offer just certificates and diplomas. And we already have it for the non-degree-granting institutions. This would make parallel language for the degree-granting ones. Sections 10 and 12 are what sometimes gets affectionately referred to as the MOOC language. This is the language that free educational courses would not be regulated by the Office of Higher Education. Section 11 is the other portion of that training requirement that we talked about before. Section 12 is another part of that MOOC language. And Section 13 is the other part of the statewide longitudinal education data systems. Section 14 is the Safety Officer Survivor Program, major students with major illness provision. Then Article 2, all of Article 2 is about terminating institutions. Two-thirds to three-fourths of it is already in rule, and we're moving it from rule to statute for greater visibility and make sure that it's clear to institutions that there are circumstances under which, if they don't do the right thing with the state grant money or the other state financial aid money, that they might not be able to continue to participate in the programs. We are adding a few additional provisions. For example, the main thing is if there's a consistent pattern of noncompliance. And there is also language that affects whether institutions would be able to be reinstated to the state grant program after they had been terminated, and then they clean up their act and want to come back in. So I'm going to stop there and see if there are questions.
Okay. And that takes us through the bulk of the original bill.
Ms. Grimes, when we were talking about the for-profits during the review, and we talked about that at this juncture, the committee would like to require more reporting. Would this be a section that we would come back to in terms of institution termination? I mean, I guess we would do that as a separate bill, but it just occurs to me that the two are a little bit connected.
Senator Bonoff, I can see where there would be a connection. There are a set of requirements in 136A, I believe it's in point 121, about what institutions have to do to be able to participate in state financial aid programs, and that seems to me the likely place that you would want to amend if you were going to add such language. This termination language, frankly, it applies mostly to extremely small institutions.
Okay. That's good. Thanks. That's helpful.
Madam Chair. If I may start by addressing the A1 amendment and moving that, please. And everybody has that in their packet. And this is a response to a request from the governor that came after the bill had been drafted. And the idea here basically is that within the Office of Higher Education, that the leadership position there should be a commissioner and not a director. So that would be a change from what we have right now, and that it would make it on par with the other comparable organizations. So that's what this...
Senator Ken, I think that's very good news, because I think what it does is it says that higher ed is important and that it equals in importance to the other cabinet functions. So I welcome the change and have always wondered about why it wasn't that and felt the same when it was Director Hegard. So,
but so... That,
Senator
that
Kent moves the A1 amendment. Are there any questions or discussions on that amendment? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you. And the second amendment that I would like to introduce is the A3 that will be distributed. And this is, it addresses the online learning, the distance learning. And the original, let's see, what were the sections in here? Was it 10 and 12? Yes. Sections 10 and 12 in the original bill addressed this, and then these would be added as an Article 3. And the idea here was to incorporate some of what Senator Miller was offering. And so since he's not here, one idea might be to lay this amendment on. If we're going to lay the whole thing on the table, we might want to lay this amendment on the table.
Senator, can I think that is what we want to do, but I think our counsel also has another comment.
Madam Chair, this was a hurried amendment, so those sections in the bill now, section in Article 1 on page 7, section 10, and page 8, section 12, would then be deleted.
Okay.
And we'd renumber. They're not competing. I think they're replacement provisions.
So these would replace.
We're not adopting the amendment. We would obviously take care of that, because you know when it happened, but you might as well include it in this amendment so we remember.
Very good. So what we're basically doing, members, we're laying this amendment on the table so that as we have the MOOCs discussion in our final bill, this will be before us for consideration.
Yes.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, so this amendment, we would amend this amendment on page 1 after line 1. You would insert page 7, delete section 10, page 8. Delete section 12. It's all right to adopt that now, even if we're going to lay it on the table.
Very good.
I would so move.
Senator Kent so moves. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that is what I have right now for written amendments. Another issue has come up, a question regarding, forgive me while I fumble with my notes, which section is it? Is it 8 and 11? 8 and 11. Yes. In sections 8 and 11, which has to do with the training requiring for-profit and not-for-profit private colleges and universities to make training available to their faculty and staff on information and advice to students regarding the transfer of credits and student financial aid. And that is on
page. I'm not finding that, Senator.
Yeah, it's on page, is it 8 of the bill?
It's line 5.17, Senator.
Okay, got it.
Where it says training.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And the concern that has been raised is where it says the school has made available to the school staff, including the admission staff, financial aid staff, administrative or office staff, and faculty, training appropriate to their employment positions that includes recommendations as to limits and types of information or advice on financial aid and transfer of credits, et cetera. The concern is that the word training may become too prescriptive and be overzealously applied and enforced. I don't know if Mr. McMahon wants to address this at this time.
Welcome, Mr. McMahon.
Thank you, Chair Bonoff, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott McMahon. I'm with the Minnesota Private College Council. We represent the 17 nonprofit liberal arts schools throughout the state of Minnesota. We employ about 14,000 employees. And as you know from our previous testimony, financial aid is a critical component of how our schools operate. There are two real concerns that we have with the language of the bill as it stands before the committee. One is the onerous aspect of what training is. In speaking with our campuses and speaking with the Office of Higher Education, we're not aware of problems that exist with our institutions and our members relating to this issue. And so we believe that that the current actions on our campuses are addressing a lot of the issues that are being raised in this proposal. And the efforts that our schools are putting forward may not fall under the category of training. It may fall into the category of communication or sharing information or so on and so forth. And so our concern is that if training is included in the language and it moves forward, that when the OHE auditors come visit our campuses and we're not doing training, that would be a red flag for institutions, even though the efforts under our campuses may, in fact, be addressing the problem in a effective and constructive way. A second issue that we have is the language on line 5.17 regarding staff appropriate to their employment positions. We're not exactly sure what that means, and we're not exactly sure if that's to be determined by the Office of Higher Education or if it's to be determined by the campuses and identifying which staff above and beyond the admission staff, financial aid staff, administrative or office staff, and faculty that's prescribed in the statute. And so we want to make sure that what we're doing is actually complying with what the state of Minnesota would be asking of us. And then a third issue that's out there, and it's just one of those things that we live with. Section 130 or Chapter 136A regards the nonprofit and the for-profit universities. It's not requirements for the University of Minnesota and the Minsky Colleges universities. And we wonder at times why it is that our institutions are being asked to do certain activities when our public counterparts aren't asked to do the same.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if Ms. Grimes would like to address this. I think part of the discussion has been, going back to some of the earlier points, that the idea of the training appropriate to their employment positions would indicate that there's a higher bar for knowledge for financial aid staff to talk about financial aid information as opposed to, say, faculty, the expectations would be different. Is built into that language, but perhaps Ms. Grimes.
Senator Kent, I guess the first question is this a friendly amendment?
It can be. I just I wanted to put that to the committee to for people to react to, because I think part of this is recognizing that there are institutions, not necessarily any of yours, where there is a concern that students are not being given full information about the amount of debt that they're taking on, and we've heard lots of testimony today about the negative effects of student debt, and so I think and I should let Ms. Grimes speak for the Office of Higher Education since
you.
This is their bill.
Madam Chair, yes, we are. Some institutions are quite tiny. We have to regulate those that are tiny and those that are much larger, and in the case of institutions that are quite tiny, there may be a very small staff. And so the person who answers the phone or answers email may need to make sure that they are not making false promises to students about that there will be no out-of-pocket cost or some such thing. As to why the language does not relate to public institutions, our regulatory language only gives us jurisdiction over private institutions.
Ms. Grimes, do you think that should be fixed in statute?
Madam Chair,
I don't understand that, given like MDE regulates all school districts. Why would you only have regulations pertaining to privates?
Well, Madam Chair, in 1995, our office was downsized by a third and changed from being a coordinating board to a services office. This was long before it became an executive branch agency. And in that time, the authority to have any regulatory responsibility over public institutions for anything other than financial aid was removed from our authority.
I didn't understand that. I can understand your concern.
So, with that, I believe that
Senator Eakin.
And Madam Chair, and I'd like to thank Senator Kent. I approached Senator Kent earlier this afternoon to discuss the possibility of this amendment. I do have some concerns based on some previous experiences I've had with agencies about things being interpreted in ways that were not terribly reasonable. And so I think that, in the case of the current administration, we'd probably find very reasonable interpretation of this, but could envision something happening in the future where somebody may interpret it to mean, a whole new training program on top of what already exists in some colleges that are doing an outstanding job of making sure that this information is available. And, I, for one, know from personal experience that there's, colleges that are doing an outstanding job that may not have, training programs in place. and that it would just be placing an added burden on top of that. So I do think we have to be careful to make sure that we're wording things in a way that can't be misinterpreted in an unreasonable way in the future. And so I would like to thank Senator Kent for listening to me on that concern, and certainly something that we can work on as we move forward too, and before it moves on in the omnibus bill, hopefully. And Senator Kent, I would defer to you as far as whether you consider this to be a friendly amendment and want it to be added now, or would prefer that we just lay it on the table.
And actually, would like to just say that I support the amendment, and I support the amendment because when I read the language, I thought that there was some concerns with regard to as to limits and types of information or advice on financial aid that includes recommend. And so it just seemed to me that that you could interpret it as you're trying to narrow the advice you're going to give a student who's really looking to get the broadest advice. So that was just a confusing way it was stated. So I appreciated the amendment in terms of clarifying that we are just making sure that the information gets there.
Madam Chair? Perhaps we can spend some more time working on this, because I think that we've sort of got a range of issues we're trying to protect and cover and address, and so maybe we can work on it in a bigger frame and come up with
something and bring that back.
Okay.
Thank you.
And with that, Madam Chair, I believe we've covered everything on our end unless there are further questions.
Well, Senator Kent moves that Senate file
N41 as amended
be laid over and for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Pratt.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, one quick question. I apologize for being distracted. I had a couple of questions on the changes around the residency. And if you could explain, being new at reading laws, explain the effect of some of the changes.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Ms. Grimes. My co-worker, Ginny Dodds, to come forward and help with that, if that's acceptable.
Sure. And Madam Chair, we are on page 2 in section 3 is the section I believe Senator Pratt is talking about.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Kent.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, Senator, could you please restate your question?
Sure. I'm kind of curious about the reason for some of the changes, and I'll have some additional questions based on our discussion of the DREAM Act. And I think what I'm going to try to do is try to understand how the two fit together.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator, I'm Ginny Dodds. I work for the Office of Higher Education. I think basically we are proposing changing the residency statute just to make it more clear. It's not really having any effect on who would be a resident and who would not. There was some redundant language, as Ms. Grime testified about, and so it's really no substantive change as to who would be considered a resident. We did hear from our Financial Aid Advisory Committee, which is made up of campus financial aid administrators, who thought the current law was a little long and difficult to explain to families, and so we tried to condense some of the language. And particularly the last clauses in the current law that deal with very narrow groups of students, like relocating here due to a natural disaster and things like that. We were kind of consolidating all of that and putting it into one clause about people who moved here for unusual circumstances, where the office would have the ability to review their cases and determine residency. So we didn't think of it as changing the policy at all on who would be a Minnesota resident.
Madam Chair, Senator, if I could just summarize the overall residency language. Basically, if you graduate from a Minnesota high school, you're considered a Minnesota resident for purposes of state financial aid, unless you have sort of actively gone to another state and established residency there. If you just go to another state to go to college, that you're still a resident of Minnesota. But if you go to another state and you work there and you live there and you're paying taxes there, then you're not a resident of Minnesota. You also can become a resident if you move to Minnesota and you live here for a year without going to college more than half time. So you didn't move here to go to college. You moved here for some other reason. But once you've been here for a year, you're a resident. That's pretty much the
Ms. Grimes.
Broadest categories.
I suspect that what Senator Pratt's getting to is the refugee status provision makes it seem like that it's up to the discretion of the Office of Higher Ed rather than a statute like if we were to approve the DREAM Act. That I think, is that what you're...
Well, I think it could be. I guess I'm kind of... Senator Peterson's question about state grants, I think, brings this more into clarity for me. To me, there seems to be two different questions here. One is, who is a resident? And one is, who do we qualify for resident tuition? Mm-hmm. And we could qualify somebody for resident tuition, but not necessarily qualify them as a resident based on their legal immigration status, where this seems to maybe, and according to Senator Pappas, we can't treat residents differently. So in Senator Pappas's, we're talking about the tuition level that they qualify at. This is where we define them as a resident and then therefore qualify them for state aid. And I would like, my concern being is that when we talk about the legal status, that this takes it a step farther than just what tuition class they qualify for.
Madam Chair, Senator, the language in statute currently makes an individual a resident of Minnesota if they were a refugee, which is a documented individual who entered the U.S. legally and was designated as a refugee. Essentially, what the language does now is waives the 12-month the requirement to reside in Minnesota for 12 months for such cases as immigrating from another country as a refugee, relocating due to a natural disaster and that type of thing. So the refugee as described there would not be an undocumented student.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Grimes, and I'm sorry, I forgot your
last
name.
That's okay. Dodds.
Dodds, thank you. So today, would an undocumented immigrant be considered a resident under the current Section 3?
Ms. Dodds.
Madam Chair, Senator, no. Not under the current residency law or under the proposed changes we're making here. Undocumented students are not, although I should back that up and say they may meet the state residency requirement, but we also have a rule in effect for financial aid programs that you have to be a U.S. citizen or eligible non-citizen. And so currently undocumented students don't meet that requirement.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Grimes.
My understanding is that the demographers estimate that approximately half of all immigrants to Minnesota are, in fact, legal mm-hmm. immigrants here, often under refugee status or similar status to that, and about half are undocumented. The governor does have a provision that's in the governor's higher education appropriations bill that would make the students who have been granted deferred action status by the Department of Homeland Security eligible for state financial aid, and it would also repeal our rule that would prevent them from getting aid. Senator Pappas, her amendment to her DREAM Act also would repeal that rule.
But this bill does not.
But this bill does not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Kent renews her motion to lay Senate File 1041 as amended on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank
Good
you,
work,
Madam
Committee.
Chair
we got through
committee.
A lot.
Exactly.
Committee is adjourned.